Give it a try. so wise shouldn't I?
Really gorgeous Frank Sinatra song there from a collection co-produced by our very own sometime fill-in DJ, Mr. C. The record's called Rarities, The Columbia Years. We heard Why Shouldn't I? Marvo Man before that, and partially accompanying the music bed right now. Untitled track number 3, the CD called Give Me Some Idea of the Boys at Work. That preceded by the great Pin Group from 1981, live at the Gladstone Hotel, July 4th, 1981. The track Jim, preceding that, Counter Intuit's self-titled record. This does feature one half of Time's New Viking with Ron House. Time Was Update, name of the track. We heard Terror's great version of God Bless the Child from Lagan Cord. Asmus Teachins from the Sex and Bestiality cassette box of 1984, the track called Humpelmann. From 2004's Mare Tranquillitatis. The track was called Enlil. New music on Nihilist from Brett Nock. The LP called The Visitor, we heard Endless Royalty. Pseudocode from The Insane Box did Keep Smiling. We heard the Danielson Family from Tell Another Joke with the Old Choppin' Block. The track was Quest for Thrills. New from David Liebehart with Adam Papagan doing the music behind him, Southern Pacific Railroad, the CD Trains of the Past and Present. Wax Idols before that, the CD Discipline and Desire. We heard Ad Re Ian. And Devendra Banhart opened the set with something from his new thing called Mala, the song You're Fine Petting Duck. And my name is Scott, and I look forward to seeing you next Monday at this very same time. Stay tuned now for too much information. This is Freeform Radio, WFMU in East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, worldwide, WFMU.org.
You're listening to WFMU. This is Too Much Information. My name is Benjamin Walker. And on April 9th, 2003, 10 years ago, tomorrow, American Marines rolled into downtown Baghdad. And two of our guests today were there. Marine Lieutenant Timothy McLaughlin was riding in a tank, and Peter Moss was in a rented SUV covering the war for the New York Times Magazine. Are you both there?
Tim is here.
Okay, so we've got you both there. And joining us in the studio is photographer Gary Knight. No, Gary Knight, sorry. Tim, Peter, and photographer Gary Knight collected many of their journals, texts, and photos for an exhibit that's called Invasion that's currently up on display at the Bronx Documentary Center. And our third guest is Mike Camber, who is a photographer as well and the founder of the BDC. And he also spent some time covering Iraq extensively. And he joins us here in the studio.
Thank you.
Okay. So thanks to you all for coming. Welcome to WFMU. I just want to say also that this is a live show today. So we'll take some phone calls maybe later on in the hour, but you can definitely chime in now on the playlist page at WFMU.org. You can post questions or comments there now. So I want to start off just talking about the anniversary itself. It seems to me that America has not really been that interested in marking the occasion. When I talked to you earlier, Tim, you mentioned that it had passed you by. You were busy at work. And obviously this exhibition is a pretty serious contribution to the anniversary, but I want to start with you. For you, what are we marking? What is this 10-year anniversary? Was it a successful war, a mistake, something that never should have happened, both? And Would you agree that America seems kind of reticent to mark the occasion?
Well, I think, you know, there are a lot of questions in there. I don't know what the anniversary marks for other people, but for me, it marks 10 years ago when the United States government and people asked the Marine Corps to invade Iraq. And I try very hard not to involve myself in conversations of whether we should have gone or what were the politics of it. At the time, I was a Marine Corps lieutenant, and my job was to do as I was told. And the Marines I fought with 10 years ago, and I and the people near me, did our job as best as we humanly could. And I'm really proud of that fact. Although, over the course of time, one of my frustrations became in looking up way far to the top reaches of my chain of command, the frustration that maybe some people didn't do their jobs or take their jobs as seriously as we fighting the war did. So that's a frustration. 10 years later, I was very fortunate to work with Gary Knight and Peter Moss and present a display of what war is actually about in written word through my diaries and Peter's writing and in photographs through Gary's pictures. And we were fortunate to do that at the Bronx Documentary Center, which is Mike Camber's location. And then, you know, beyond setting that up, the presentation, life gets busy for a lot of people with families and commitments and work. So I don't focus on a 10-year anniversary much personally, but our focus has been on reminding people that these events took place and that they had huge consequences for the people who were involved, whether you're a veteran now or a civilian remaining in Iraq. And one of my frustrations is that the world moves on, you know, as it should in a lot of ways. But for those of us who were involved, parts of us don't get to move on. And that was the purpose of our exhibit, at least from my point of view. And I know Peter has a point of view, and Gary does, and I'm sure Mike does as well.
Yeah. You know, when you talk about the personal connections, though, the show really starts with your journals that you made, writings, drawings, songs that you put together while you were there in Iraq 10 years ago. And Peter writes about taking them out of a trunk in your family house, and they still had grains of sand in them. So you had put them away for a while, and I'm wondering for you, when you took them out, you know, now they're displayed on the walls of this exhibit, what were the ones that, you know, stood out for you that sort of jarred you when you started looking at these pages again?
Yeah, the story of writing the diaries or of Peter finding them are stories unto themselves, but I didn't read them again for about 10 years until Peter asked me to. And But one thing I wish I could share with people, which we didn't get into the exhibit, Peter, is I had a young Marine named Lance Corporal Johnson who was accidentally shot in the leg right through the femur. And what I wrote about was how young he is, or was at the time, reflective of how young all of us were at the time. Johnson is sitting there on a gurney, his leg is bleeding, and the doctors are taking care of him. I'll edit for public radio consumption, but my senior enlisted guy said to Johnson, "Johnson, don't worry about it. Think of all the girls you've had sex with." And Johnson, bleeding on the table, says, "I've only had sex once, Gunny." And he said, "Well, think of all the ways you had sex with her, at least." And he said, "It didn't last that long." And that, for me, in a coarse and crude way, which is how the Marine Corps operates a lot of the time, just reflects that these are 18-year-old kids, and me, a 24 or 5-year-old lieutenant, young man, these are not old and experienced people you're asking to go to war. These are young kids. Huh. And that's what I wish part of my project could convey.
Well, you definitely talk about the consequences and the impossibility of forgetting in a way. One of the pieces in the show is your medical diagnosis of PTSD. It's quite prominent in the exhibition. So it seems that that's for many individuals like yourself, the marking of the anniversary probably is secondary into something that never has gone away.
Yeah, and when people talk about that, I no longer call it PTSD. I simply refer to it as PTS. It's not a disorder, and it frustrates me that that would be the diagnosis or the way it's colloquially referred to. It's just a post-traumatic stress reaction, which is a normal consequence of seeing people die around you and killing people and having your friends not make it and making mistakes and killing civilians. So it's not a disorder. It's just a normal consequence or reaction or result of war. Mm-hmm. And it was important to me to include that in the exhibit because in the military there's a stigma attached to it and society asks questions about it, and it's not something you can see like a missing leg, but to be able to share a diagnosis, to be in a position to share a diagnosis, if it can show what the consequences are in the typewritten font that the VA uses, and attach some tangential meaning to that as opposed to some abstract disorder idea, it's a real consequence for people who fight or who are involved in fighting or at the other end of the fighting. And I was happy to be able to share that at not much risk to myself, I don't think. So, but if it can help other people say, yeah, this is, it's no big deal in a bad sense, and it's a normal reaction that people have, then that's why I shared it.
Yeah, I want to come back to that a little more in a bit. But Peter, oh wait, and also Tim, if you could take us off speakerphone, I think we'll have a little less feedback.
Oh, sure, absolutely.
Okay, so Peter.
Still there?
Yeah, we're there. Peter?
Yeah.
So it seems to me that we can get a sense of the, the media's interest in this anniversary by simply looking at how difficult, easy it was for you to get folks interested in this exhibit. Were you booked solid for the last few weeks? National television, no time for family work?
Well, actually, it's been really interesting because, first off, it was really hard for us to find a gallery or museum that would host this exhibit. A year ago, when we kind of started talking to people, trying to get people interested, at curators at museums and galleries, we just kind of had this deafening silence in terms of responses. We would be lucky to get an explicit answer or a no from places. Most places just didn't even respond, and
not even the generic email response.
Not even, yeah. So, lots of folks just didn't even respond, and there was one well-known museum where the curator responded by saying, "I don't want to be involved in any more exhibits about war or violence." And on a human level, I guess I can understand that. It's hard stuff, and you don't want to have to reckon with hard stuff, but it's also necessary. Anyways, we had an extremely difficult time placing this exhibit, and we went to Mike Camber at the Bronx Documentary Center, and because it's a really unique place, and Mike himself is a war photographer, a former war photographer, he understood it immediately what this exhibit consisted of and why it was necessary to put it on, and actually how interesting it would be. And the strange thing is, actually, that the exhibit's gotten a lot of attention. It's gotten a tremendous amount of media attention, actually. It's, you know, CBS Evening News has done stuff on it, The Times, The New Yorker, other places have written about it. But the reason is, other than the fact that it's a really interesting exhibit, I think, is that there hasn't been much else for the media to write about during this kind of period of 10-year reflection on the Iraq War, because the U.S. government is not marking the 10-year anniversary anyway. It wants to forget about it. The U.S. military, likewise, is not marking it anyway. You know, you don't see or read anything about official ceremonies. So the result is that there are just a couple of things going on that, you know, in our case, a couple of, you know, relentless journalists and a Marine put together. So it's been both really hard. It's been really nice that some folks are paying attention to the exhibit now, but it's sad that the reason that attention is being paid to this exhibit is because there's not much else out there for people who want to try to remember and want to try to learn and are able to actually grab onto.
So you're saying there has been no official response from anyone, you know, the Bush administration, Obama, nothing?
No. Well, the amazing, you know, leading up to this 10-year anniversary period, which began on March 19th, which was the 10-year anniversary of the day the first tanks headed over the border. That was the day that, you know, Tim drove his tank over the border and I drove my SUV over the border. You know, heading into that this anniversary period, tomorrow marks the 10-year anniversary of the day that the statue of Saddam Hussein was taken down in Firdaus Square. Coming into that anniversary period, I thought that there would be something from the U.S. government, but as it turned out, on that day, March 19th, President Obama issued a 250-word press release. He didn't mention in anything he said that day anything about the Iraq War. There was nothing said on the floors of Congress. Former President Bush said nothing on that day.
Rumsfeld?
Former Vice President Dick Cheney said nothing on that day. The only person who said anything, and it was actually kind of pathetic, I think, was former Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, who tweeted one tweet, you know, 40 words about the invasion of Iraq, and
wow,
that was it. So there's been a deafening silence, and a really conspicuous and, to me, surprising one, from everybody and everything in the government and in the military, current and former, related to Iraq.
So Mike, I want to bring you in here. Can you talk a bit about how the exhibit ended up at the center? Was it, you know, they say you got it right away.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a natural. I was in and out of Iraq between 2003 and January of 2012, working for the New York Times. So, you know, you know, I remember Michael Hare wrote, speaking of Vietnam, something about, you know, Vietnam is what we had in place of happy childhoods. And I kind of felt like Iraq was that for me. It was, you know, sort of the central event of my life. And I think for a lot of us that served there and spent time there. And there was no way I was going to let the 10th anniversary go by and not use that as an occasion to try to, you know, spark some debate and, and remind, you know, the Americans of what we went through, of the you know, thousands and thousands of Americans that were killed and Iraqis that were killed. And, you know, I think we've spent between $2 and $3 trillion, that's with a T. You know, it's to me, it's the most significant thing we've done since, you know, Vietnam in terms of, you know, foreign interventions and such. And good or bad, there should be a debate about it. We should be talking about it.
And the fact that that's not taking place, you know, at least on the official level, as Peter just mentioned, what does that say about America? Do we want to forget this? Is it an unhappy childhood that we just want to put away?
You're going above my pay grade at this point, as they say in the military. Yeah, I think, you know, it was a tough war. It was a tough war to cover. You know, it was a guerrilla war, no clear front lines. It got very, very complicated very quickly. I mean, even in 2003, there were different groups. They were fighting against each other. They were fighting against the U.S. You know, it was, even if you were against the war, it was very hard to know what to do. You know, I remember very, very early on it became, well, we can't abandon the country because now we've unleashed a civil war, you know.
So that was you bought it at
you broke it. You bought it.
What store was that?
I think Colin Powell said
yeah,
he
it was,
quartered somebody.
I know, but what was the store?
I think it was supposed to be Pottery Barn.
Yes,
but actually, that's not actually the policy at Pottery Barn, but that's what Colin Powell thought the policy was.
Well, Mike has a book that I want to talk about in a little bit as well. But tomorrow is the actual anniversary of the day that the statue came down outside the Palestine Hotel. And Tim, both you and Peter were there. Peter, you've written about this media event in an exhaustive piece for The New Yorker a few years ago that it's one of my favorite pieces about the war. There are so many things in there that I still think about, you know, years later. But I wanted to get both of you who were there to talk about, you know, what happened on this day and what shouldn't have happened. Tim, let's go back to you.
What happened?
Yeah.
Well, to answer the first question, what shouldn't have happened, look at it from different points of view. From my point of view, I'm just a Marine. And there's nothing that occurred that day that I would change from the Marine Corps point of view. Leading up to that day, we were engaged in combat operations for 3 weeks, roughly, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Heavy fighting followed by boredom, followed by heavy fighting. Following April 9th, there was still fighting going on. You know, Corporal Gonzalez was killed a few days later. Corporal Milio was killed a few days later. So April 9th, to me, is just in the middle of all that. For the rest of the world who would have been watching at home on their couches, they saw something on TV as well that reflected what the broadcast media showed them. But all that was a snippet in time, a short soundbite or a picture that didn't really have anything to do with the combat operations that were ongoing, with the people who were dying. So on April 9th, back up a step. Except for a moment that the Marine Corps is a particularly patriotic service, there are not that many of us. And of the many things we do well, we fight battles. We put our sticker on everything. If you've ever driven around on the highway, you can see that. Everybody's got a Marine Corps sticker on if they were in the Marine Corps. So part of that is reflected in the Marine Corps ethos. You're patriotic, you love your country, you carry a flag with you sometimes, you carry a sticker with you other times. I happen to be a guy who had a flag with me. There were lots of us. I love my country. I was doing what I was told to do by my country, so I had my American flag, which was reflective of my patriotism, which you'd find among lots of Marines in the Marine Corps. A few times during our route up, I tried to get a picture of my flag in Iraq so that I would have it for my own posterity to perhaps show my grandkids someday. We literally got shot at one day, so no picture of my flag. Another day, the flagpole got run over by another tank. I think they were messing with me.
As you were trying to put it up?
Yeah, but not in front of anybody, just for myself. And one of my buddies, I think, literally ran my flagpole over.
Yeah, I think they were messing with you.
Yeah, I think they were messing with me at that point. So on April 9th, we get to this square. Nobody's shooting at us. And my company commander says, "Hey, Mac, go get your flag. We'll get a picture for you." So that's all that happened for me. I understand at the same time that the rest of the world saw that because it's what was broadcast. And spins or opinions or images were put together and then people changed their minds later on. That's all real as well. I fully understand the symbology that goes with the flag. But that's not what it was intended as, at least from a Marine Corps point of view, or at least a young Marine's point of view. So that's the story of my flag. It had nothing to do with the combat operations, which are of utmost importance to me and the consequences of those. It's just a thing that everybody saw on TV and wound up having an opinion about.
So when you handed it to the your colleague that was up on the statue, did you know that that's where it was going to go for your picture?
No.
The Saddam statue's head?
No. Corporal Chin was at the top. Sergeant Sutherland was underneath him. Gunny Lambert was there. Captain Lewis was there. A number of other Marines were there. Handed it to Captain Lewis. Didn't know if it was going to be waved or put on the shoulder or draped nearby. And I don't think Corporal Chin knew either. I think he says, I just got it and stuck it on the face, took it down, put up an Iraq flag, took it down, and then kept going. But that's about it. It's a remarkably uninteresting story when you strip away the media.
Well, I mean, for Peter, I think you would disagree. You wrote in, you know, a very, very long piece. You were obsessed with the story for a long time. What for you is so, you know, important about what happened on this day?
Well, I think actually, you know, I'm with Tim. It was a remarkably uninteresting event, but what made it interesting was the media, and so the kind of, you know, creation of the event by the media was actually quite fascinating. You know, the event itself, I was there too. You know, I had been driving along with Tim's battalion in my SUV, and when I, you know, was watching the few Iraqis and then the Marines go after the statue and put up the flag, I mean, I was you know, paying 10% attention to that. I was at Fierro Square because it wasn't important. It was just kind of like, you know, unimportant stuff compared to absolutely everything else that I'd seen and lived through during the invasion. And it was unimportant also in relation to other things that were going on in Baghdad on that day. The city was being looted, you know, the government buildings and many other structures were being, you know, taken apart almost quite literally, or they were on fire, there was still fighting going on. It was chaos, and that was much more important and much more telling about the future of Iraq. But, you know, unfortunately, the event that the media focused on was this, you know, toppling of the statue. And I kind of became obsessed by it in a way because I wanted to figure out how did this kind of,
yeah,
you know, monstrous, monstrously important event, or seemingly important event, get created out of nothing. I was there. It was nothing. It wasn't important. And so I tracked down all the journalists and all the Marines involved, including, you know, producers who were in TV studios making decisions about what to put on the air and why to keep it on the air and how often to repeat it on the air. And it turned out to be a really fascinating story about how an event, although it might actually happen in a strict sense, isn't a really authentic event if it's been kind of created or influenced by the media and the media's role isn't reported. So, you know, on that day, what people sitting in their living rooms in America saw was, you know, some Iraqis taking down this statue and a couple of Marines there or whatever. But the actual fact of it was that, you know, mostly that square was empty, and most of the people in that square, and I've kind of done, you know, really good kind of forensic analysis of all the video and photo footage, most of the people in that square, and there weren't that many, a couple hundred, were Marines or journalists. And then, you know, all of the kind of nice shots you got of Iraqis slapping their shoes against the toppled head of Saddam Hussein, you know, well, these Iraqis were surrounded by rings of photographers, but you didn't see that. And so the way that the media presented this event, by cutting the media out, made the context go away. People thought, oh, yes, this is Iraqis just doing this on their own with a little bit of help from Marines. But no, it was something much more concocted, in the sense of everybody was reacting to the media, the presence of the media. The commander who gave the order to take down the statue told me afterwards, yeah, you know, I gave the order to take it down because this was being broadcast and it would be a bad image for the statue to remain standing once its toppling had kind of begun and not been accomplished. And this wasn't a kind of, you know, unusually manipulative decision he made. I think any good commander would make that same decision. But it's the media doesn't have to kind of, you know, go along with it uncritically. The media should report that, you know, actually this decision to take down the statue was made as a result of the media's presence, not as a result of something that was unrelated to all these journalists there.
Yeah.
So I just kind of reconstructed and deconstructed this media event, which really was a false event in many ways, including false as far as meaningful, providing meaningful information to us about what was going on in Iraq and what would happen in Iraq over the next years.
Sure, sure. But it's, you keep dancing around this issue of, like, who was responsible here. I mean, is it, it's not like that line from Liberty Valance, it seems like. It's you know, don't bother with the facts, print the legend. It seems that, like, there were individuals responsible for putting this concocting this fake story.
Well, you know, I maybe I shouldn't use the word concocted, and even the word fake is too strong, because fake implies that, you know, it was entirely concocted from beginning to end, and it wasn't, in the sense of, like, there was no grand plan from up high in the Pentagon, and, you know, or in the White House. There are a lot of things we can criticize the Pentagon and the White House for, but they were not involved in creating this event. You know,
the media was, though.
The scene wasn't involved in creating the event in any kind of premeditated or any significantly premeditated way. You know, the concoction Conduction's a strong word, so maybe, you know, the better word is, you know, influence of the media was the key thing, so that the media was an active participant in creating this event, yet that information was not conveyed to people, and that information was very important in terms of figuring out really how authentic and meaningful this event was.
Yeah, but you talk about all the media that's not in the photos who are there. And I'm curious, Mike, for you, you know, you were not there, but as a photojournalist, it seems that, you know, with this story, you have been in situations where there is this much media, and yet they end up not in the footage. You know, they're sort of there, you know.
Sure, sure. Well, there's a few different there's a few different issues there. I mean, one is you know, there's many instances of this where the photographers will band together. They'll stand on one side and shoot all in the same direction. You don't want any other photographers in your shot, obviously. Television is the same. You want to create that fly-on-the-wall illusion that we, you know, strive for. And, you know, that's one issue. But, you know, of course, you can do a lot of things with a telephoto lens. You can zoom in and crop things out. But I think with this photo, I mean, Peter knows far more about it than I do, but with this whole event, the toppling of the statue, you know, sort of a perfect storm, because Firdaus Square is right at the nexus of the Sheraton and Palestine hotels, and every journalist in Baghdad was in those hotels, or virtually every journalist who had been staying in Baghdad, you know. So, I mean, it's right at the foot of where the press is staying. You know, the press needs a story. They're on deadlines. They're in a hurry. Sometimes they're scared to go out. There's bullets flying, you know. To go out into Baghdad and maybe get killed trying to dig out the real story, that's a tough assignment. But you can literally shoot out your window and get footage of this statue being toppled, and boom, you've got a story for your boss back in New York, and there it is.
Yeah, but Peter, you talk about, you know, the decision makers that weren't there outside, sort of directing journalists that you interviewed and you put stories back together, sort of really trying to play up something, even when the journalists were saying to their editors, but wait, this, like you just told us, wasn't exactly true.
Well, there's an echo chamber effect that kind of was at play here, too. Gary Knight, who's our colleague, the photographer, who's kind of the third person with me and Tim who put the exhibit together, Gary was also at Firdaus Square. He also, you know, had this rented SUV that he drove along with Tim's battalion and me and got to Baghdad. Gary was there, and he was at the square, had the same reaction I had, which is, you know, this is kind of nice and fun and silly or whatever, but it's not important. He wasn't taking pictures, but then he got a call on his satellite phone from his editor in New York. And his editor in New York said, you know, what are you doing? And Gary said, well, I'm just standing here. You know, there's this kind of thing going on here at the statue. And the editor said, you're taking pictures, aren't you? This is really important. I'm watching on CNN right now. And Gary said, no, it's not important. And but the editor said, take pictures. This is the news. This is what's happening. This is what everybody is watching and everybody is talking about and everybody will be talking about. Take pictures. And so, you know, and I'm telling Gary's story here, but, you know, the story Gary tells, which is, has been, you know, replicated in similar ways by many other journalists, is that, you know, he just stood there basically still talking to his boss and then started shooting frames of the statue being taken down because he was being told to, and he was being told that that was the picture that they wanted and the picture that they would end up using. And that happened with a lot of journalists. There was a San Francisco Chronicle reporter I talked to, Robert Collier, who had been in Baghdad during the invasion. And when the statue was taken down, or after, I should say, you know, he filed a story to his editors in San Francisco, which accurately said, you know, this wasn't that big of a deal. There's much more of greater importance going on. The war was still going on. Iraq was an extremely troubled place. Things didn't look very good. The story was changed back home by the editors. And it wasn't changed because they had, you know, better sources of information than their correspondent in Baghdad. It was changed because they had been watching these TV images, and they were affected by what they saw on TV from the CNN cameras, not from what their own reporter was actually reporting. And they didn't want to be out of step with what everybody else was reporting.
So, Tim, I want to come back to you to talk about the flag a little bit more. What, you know, the flag that you just told us about is in the exhibit. It's obviously something, you know, very important with you that you brought with you. But I'm wondering if you could tell us the story about this flag, and where it came from, and why it was so important to you.
Well, it was important to me because it's the United States flag, and I was a Marine. So that's the short and simple and complete answer to that. It in and of itself was not particularly important. If you had given me any other flag from anywhere, it would have been the flag I carried. This particular flag was given to me by a congressional staffer who was a family friend whose name I truly forget. It was given to me a few days after the 9/11 attacks, although other than that, it was unrelated. As an even younger Marine lieutenant, I worked at the Pentagon while I rehabbed from a severely broken leg, and I spent September 11th, 2001, helping the fire and rescue personnel inside the courtyard of the Pentagon. And a few days later, I had made my way back to my older brother's house. Family friend comes down. I think she literally had two extra flags in her car. She said, "Hey, I don't know what to do, but you guys have had a tough week." She gave us each these very standard, very normal-looking flags in a cardboard box. And I just happened to hold on to that because it probably saved me $8.95 from having to buy one on my own. So that's where it came from. It was important to me because, like I said, Marine Corps, I love my country, still do, still love the Marine Corps. I have an American flag at home. I have a Marine Corps flag at home. It's just the nature of the business from the Marine Corps' point of view. So that's where it came from. Like I said, I know stories attach and symbolism attaches, and that's all right and correct as well. But for me, it's a very normal flag and a very normal thing of taking a picture of my flag, which the rest of the world saw and ran with.
Sure, but in the journal you talk about, you do an accounting of the day of 9/11 for you at the Pentagon, and it seems for you that this flag becomes very important as a symbol of what happened to you and the country on that day.
No, I disagree with that, and I don't think that's in my diaries. I wrote extensively about my day on September 11th, 2001, but I'm nearly certain I didn't write a thing about somebody coming to give me a flag after that.
I thought that at the end of the day, you talk about the story. I mean, maybe it's just for me reading more into it, in that you get the flag at the end of the day. That's the
No, and I don't mean to correct you, but I think that's not in there. And but you know, people remember things differently, and that's how symbology is.
Yeah. I guess, you know, what it really comes down to for me, you know, and so many people at this time, and you referenced this earlier, there were so many Americans who were, you know, were being driven crazy by some of the connections being made between 9/11 and the invasion of Iraq, even though, you know, it's been proven now countless times that Saddam Hussein really didn't have anything to do.
Well, I can't actually answer that directly, because on April 9th, 2003, I got to the square, and like Peter said, there were journalists everywhere, and a journalist who I have tremendous respect for, his name's Steve Farrell, worked for either the London Times or Guardian at the time. He interviewed me that day, and my interview from April 9th, 2003 appears, you can read it, and he said, "What about this connection between September 11th and Iraq?" And my answer, in quotations in his article, is, "I know Saddam Hussein didn't have anything to do with 9/11, but I think that given the opportunity, someone like Saddam Hussein would be certainly willing to try to inflict damage on the West." So in that sense, there's a philosophical connection, but at the time, I didn't think Saddam had anything to do with it. Today, I still don't. I think history has proven that out.
Yeah.
But that would have been my answer then and still now.
Yeah, you know, I can remember I was covering the war in Liberia and Cote d'Ivoire. I was based in West Africa, and you know, I remember I wanted to go to Iraq, but you know, I was tied up over in Africa, and I was covering these dictatorships, you know, just these horrible dictatorships where people really, you know, sort of like organized crime syndicates that were running these countries and had people under their thumbs. And I thought the war in Iraq was a great idea, you know, in the beginning, you know, before the invasion, of course. It just seemed so clean and simple, and this is a bad guy, and had nothing to do with WMDs, you know. I just thought, this guy's a killer, and he's got to be taken out, and we'll just instill democracy. What could be simpler than that? And once I got there, and I quickly got an education on what the real world was like over there.
Yeah, but as a war photographer, you know, working in these dictatorships, and did you have a sense that might actually be a little harder than it looked on paper, and the way that, you know, some of the cases that we had seen made, that how this could work, something that you were for?
Yeah, I mean, sure, I'd, you know, followed Vietnam. I mean, I grew up on the Vietnam War, watching it on TV and all, and read about it. I mean, I know how counterinsurgencies work and such, but, you know, I guess I had, just a lot more faith in the highest reaches of the U.S. government to carry out the mission in a competent fashion, really.
Yeah.
Well, one of the, and that goes back to what I was talking about, you know, me and my Marines, we worked as hard as we could to do as best as we could in awful circumstances. And you get someone like General Shinseki, to his incredible credit, who spoke up and said, hey, this, quote, plan you guys have, you might want to rethink it. And to his credit, he spoke up and said that, which needed to be said, but then he was asked to step aside.
Yeah.
He wanted to go in heavy. He said, we need a lot of troops, we need to go in there, we need to occupy the place and hold it down and, you know, instill order and such. And Rumsfeld was very clear, you know, he had a doctrine, and it was, we're going to go in there light and fast and get this over with, and we'll have, you know, U.S. combat troops out in no time. And, I mean, maybe Peter can weigh in on that.
Yeah, Peter?
I think that both of one of the kind of problems I have with the debate, but just I guess my own personal feeling about what conclusions we should make, and these are just my feelings, and I, you know, for whatever they're worth, is that, you know, light and fast certainly didn't work, but, you know, heavy and long wasn't going to work either. I don't think the problem was execution. Certainly the occupation was horribly executed. I mean, just, you know, incompetent officials on the American side, from, you know, the 23-year-olds just out of college who were, you know, tasked with running in Iraqi ministries, to, you know, Jerry Bremer, who was in charge of the whole occupation. Yeah, it was, you know, just messed up from the get-go. Terrible decisions made, terrible people making the decisions in terms of competency. But I don't think that was the real problem, actually. I don't think that it would have succeeded even if you had more brilliant people there. You know, I don't think that a foreign army in any given country at this in this day and age is going to remain popular and successful for very long. And getting back to what Tim was mentioning, which is just so true at the beginning of the show about, you know, was it Lance Corporal Johnson, who was 18 years old? You know, the vast majority, beyond majority, I mean, you know, I don't know, 80-90% of the actual boots on the ground that you have in the U.S. Army, U.S. Marines, are 18-year-old kids or thereabouts. You know, even 25-year-olds like Tim are the minority, and then the officers, you know, there are really very few of those around. So basically, you know, we're expecting 18-year-olds to, with their weapons and with just their military training, to somehow be really kind of sensitive operators and occupiers of a foreign country over a long term. No, that's just asking too much of any 18-year-old of any army to operate that way in a foreign country. So I think the whole idea of, like, we botched the occupation proceeds on a foundation that is really weak, which is that the occupation could have succeeded if it had been executed better.
Right, right. Yeah, well, that's, we can debate that forever. But
yeah,
certainly when you, you know, certainly when you send groups of 18-year-olds in there from you know, Middle America, and immediately, I mean, almost on the first day they get there, you task them with nation building and taking over government. And, you know, they're putting lieutenants in charge of whole neighborhoods with no translators. Nobody speaks Arabic. And, you know, they're tasked with getting the neighborhood up and running, getting electricity, getting water. You know, I mean, it was extraordinary to see this. And these guys are completely unequipped, you know. So, I mean, there's, you know, but again, we can argue it forever. But there's, to me, the key point, or one of the key points comes in the book, with the Emerald City book by Rajiv from the Washington Post, forgetting the exact title. And he describes, you know, the military guys getting to Baghdad and running into the State Department guys and saying, so, you know, here we are, and let's execute the post-war plan. Give us the post-war plan. And the State Department guys literally saying, we thought you had the post-war plan. Yeah. We don't have any post-war plan.
It's like the worst cartoon that, you know, It's terrible.
You can't make this up.
Yeah, you can't make this up.
And you know, Peter very well may be right. You know, maybe there was no correct way to do it, but this certainly wasn't it.
But when I think back to 10 years ago tomorrow when I was watching the, you know, and again, like seeing those images being played over and over again, I personally felt like I was watching a manufactured media event. But I, in a way, I kind of hoped it was true. I definitely went into the war really, really, really uncomfortable with some of the justifications we had for going into it. I had many, many questions about the veracity of some of the claims. But at the same time, I didn't want to be proved right. There was, you know, definitely a moment where if this is over, this is great. But it wasn't. And it seemed to me that those questions we have that, you know, all three of you have been talking about, these questions, they became sort of not the point or sort of in the way very quickly. Like once things got complicated in Iraq, that idea of going back to debating over the justifications or the stories of Judith Miller or all you know, or Colin Powell's UN speech, they seemed to really get in the way of the job like that you know, soldiers like you were supposed to do, Tim. And I found that so frustrating.
Well, I have actually never seen the footage you've seen. There's no internet where I was, and no mobile phones. So I've seen pictures, but I've never seen those descriptions you've seen. And then what you described is how movies work. Movies have a beginning, a middle, an end. They have a plot, and someone writes it. And at the end, usually you feel pretty good, unless you're watching, you know, The Empire Strikes Back. But you described how movies work. War is not a movie. It may be turned into a movie by Hollywood for profit. It may be turned into easily understood nuggets by politicians who have a point of view and media who are trying to sell commercial space. But one of the things I like about programs like this is an opportunity to talk about the complexity of war, because it's not a movie. Life goes on that doesn't have happy consequences for most people who are involved. And that's why this idea of talking about April 9th and a flag and a statue has so little resonance with me, because all of the questions going into war, were the reasons given correct? Were the weapons of mass destruction? What happens when you send 18-year-olds? What happens after when you send 18-year-olds? What happens when you take a Marine Corps that's trained to fight and kill and ask them to nation build?
Yeah.
Well, I guarantee you the Marine Corps will figure it out very quickly as best as they can, but keep in mind what the primary mission is. It's to fight and kill. So we'll figure it all out, but all of those other nuanced questions are so much more interesting than how movies work. You know, go see Zero Dark Thirty if you want to see a movie. It doesn't have any relation to reality.
Yeah.
The other movie, you want to talk about a movie that really doesn't
matter? Yeah, The Hurt Locker.
The Hurt Locker. We used to howl with laughter in Iraq. Well, everybody thought that movie was the real thing, you know, back home. And we would put that on and just laugh for 2 hours. I mean, it was a comic book.
Yeah, but, you know, I have to say, Tim, that, like, where are Americans supposed to learn about these nuanced, complicated questions? Because when I look at what the media did, you know, we've been talking about government screw-ups here, but, you know, including this day, including the lead-up to the war, including the complicated stories, I'm sorry, like, and I have two members of this team here, Peter and, like, colossal screw-ups.
Well, and you're exactly right, and that may have something to do with the quiet reaction we got from interest in the project. But when Gary, Peter, and I embarked on this project, somebody asked me, what's the point of this? I think it was my wife. She actually said, why are you doing this, Tim? And I thought about it, and my answer reflects your question, which is there is so little publicly available information that describes the nuances and complexities. So take my diary, for instance. My diary has nothing to do with the political discussions and the governmental policies, but at least it's a representation of the complexities of war while it's happening. So to introduce that into the stream of commerce or the stream of media and make it available for people who are at least interested in trying to understand the complexities. Making it available to people so that they can form an opinion as opposed to being fed an opinion. And I don't care what their opinion is, and I hope almost all of their opinions is that war is awful stuff and we should think twice about doing this next time. If I could get one person to read it, form that opinion, and move on, it would be worth it for me. Because you're right, there is a dearth of real information, source material, if you will, available. Take WikiLeaks. You know, on one hand, that's a breach of secure information. On the other hand, at least it's source material.
Yeah.
I also think that there were, you know, in defense of journalists, I mean, there
well,
were...
Good, there were, good luck, dude.
Yeah. There were a lot of journalists who did do a good job. I mean, you know, starting with the Philadelphia Inquirer and I think Knight Ritter. I mean, they did, you know, pretty extensive reporting long before the war, calling into question the whole WMD thing. You know, and then during the war, there were good journalists. I mean, if today, if you read Peter Moss's New York Times article from, you know, 2003, I mean, it holds up. It stands up. I mean, it's a complex, good, solid piece of journalism. And I was over there for years, you know, working for the New York Times with you know, Sabrina Tavernese and Dexter Filkins and, you know, lots of great journalists, some who gave their lives, you know, literally gave Iraqi journalists in particular who gave their lives to get pictures out and stories out. I mean, you know, 150 Iraqi journalists were killed in that war, putting out information, good, solid information. And I would come back, you know, from my tours there to America, and I'm sorry, but, you know, hardly anybody was reading this stuff, you know. I mean, I talked to people on the street, and people weren't following the war, you know, and weren't keyed in on it. And, you know, to some degree, the American people need to, you know, look in the mirror a little bit. You can't blame it all on the journalists.
I think it's the distinction between journalists and the media industry. Because all of my experiences with almost all of the journalists I've ever interacted with is that they're out there trying to do the right thing and get this information to an American public that's usually too lazy to review it, and a media industry that knows that.
Yeah.
And they just feed them what will sell a commercial space.
But
I would say that one of the kind of how do people figure out what to think or get into complexities is talk to a soldier, talk to a Marine. You know, one of the problems, I think, of our society, the way that kind of military-civilian relations are in the society, is that the military, now that it's a volunteer military, actually is a relatively small number of self-selecting people, and it doesn't represent in many ways, geographically or economically or socially, cross-section of the country. So you have a lot of civilians who have no contact whatsoever with the military, and, you know, I've never talked to a soldier or Marine, and don't have access to people who really know more about war than the civilians do. And, you know, actually, you know, my experience has been that soldiers and Marines, you know, they're less gung-ho and more realistic about war ahead of time than civilians are, and that's often the way it is in terms of political, you know, civilian-military relations. And I think that's one thing that maybe we're still missing in this society is that there's not enough contact and interchange between the civilian and military parts of our society.
But I want to come back to this, you know, the media event of the 9th, Peter, because for me, one of the things I got from reading that article a few years ago was a sort of relief and an understanding that, yes, all my anger and frustration at the media machine was totally valid. I mean, it's just that there may have not been a plan to sort of keep something like this craziness from happening, but it still happened because of the incompetence. And, you know, there was a lot of mistakes that were... There seems to be some culpability there that was never really acknowledged.
Well, you know, one of the frustrations that I have... you know, I covered a lot of foreign wars, and Mike has too, and, you know... you go off, you cover a war, you go back maybe and do some stories afterwards and you know, kind of tisk-tisk, you know, this place still hasn't come to grips with what happened. And now I find myself living in a post-conflict society here in America where a lot of institutions, not just the media institution, though that's certainly an important one, but, you know, political institution and military institutions too, you know, have not come to grips with what's happened, with what went wrong, how it went wrong, and made amends and made corrections so it doesn't happen again. So, you know, excuse me, I, you know, I'm frustrated. I remain frustrated with the media, but I remain more frustrated with my society at large, actually. I feel, you know, I covered the war in Bosnia in the 90s, and I went back to the former Yugoslavia afterwards and went back to Serbia, which was responsible for starting and the war in Bosnia and killing a huge number of people. And that was a society that still is not reconciled, has not admitted what it did. Right. But I find myself feeling the same way now about my own society. And it's more than just the media.
Yeah, so the exhibit is up. How long is the exhibit still up for?
It's up until April 19th, though it's looking like we may leave it up another week or so. So if you check our website, which is bronxdoc.org, you'll be able to see if it's extended. But it'll certainly be there through April 19th.
And Tim, for you, do you think this exhibit should maybe travel elsewhere? Do you want to stay involved with the project, see if you want to get it out to other places?
I would love for it to be available to anyone who would have the interest in looking at it. One of the things we did early on is both have a physical exhibit at the Bronx Documentary Center, which I hope travels, but also make it available online. So we have a website. It's www.wardiaries.org, and you can actually download the entire diary, which is the majority of the exhibit. And we did it that way so that people in Portland, Oregon, or Honolulu, or Florida, wherever the exhibit may not go, if they were interested in reviewing it, they could still do it without having to travel to the physical location.
Yeah. So Tim, is there something in, you know, is there a piece you mentioned about, you know, things that get to the more complicated questions? I think, you know, that there's a few that stand out for me, but for you in the diary journals yourself, what do you feel is perhaps one of the images or stories that for you really allows someone to quickly experience some of these more complications and nuances?
Well, you know, take the shoot, don't shoot criteria, which Peter's heard me talk about before. Take a young Marine Corps lieutenant who's 25 years old, put him in an M1A1 tank that can basically destroy anything in its path, put him at the front of a battalion in an armored vehicle, then give him intelligence that says, we're jamming radio signals, so the enemy's not going to be able to call in advance warning of our approach down the road. The way we expect them to deal with that is instead of radio signals, which are jammed, we expect them to send runners and cars moving very rapidly fast away from you, so they'll go screaming down away from you and tell the enemy positions that you're coming. Okay? Makes sense to me. So we're moving. I'm in the front of the column. There's nobody in front of me, so it's my decision to shoot or don't shoot. And sure enough, just as they predicted, radio signals jamming, car pops out and goes flying away from me as fast as it can. I've got a few seconds to decide whether to shoot or not shoot before he's out of my range. And if I don't shoot and he goes and tells the bad guys that we're coming and they shoot and they kill us, that's bad news. So we engage, we disable the taxi, wind up killing a taxi cab driver. I assume that he died. I didn't see him die, but I'm pretty sure he did. So I felt awful about that, truly just awful. I did exactly as I was told, made the decision in a split second, which I thought was the right one, and somebody who didn't need to get shot got shot. Literally 3 days later, I'm in the next town. You can suppose that I'm probably feeling badly about that previous incident in AFAC. And this time, I'm in the front of the battalion again, and in my M1A1 tank. It's my job to make sure I get it right. We go in, and my gunner says, "Hey, sir, I'm identifying some, I think he said, suspicious-looking dudes in the grove right up ahead." Right up ahead meant about 50 yards. So I look down my scope. Oh, can't see any weapons, so we can't shoot them. So just keep watching, he says. Just keep watching them. Sure enough, they open fire and wind up killing a Marine behind me who's in a light-skinned vehicle. So the first time I shoot too fast based on information that I think I'm getting right, and the wrong person dies. The next time, you know, hesitate a few seconds, Marine dies. And those are decisions being made as best as we can. They just don't. And, you know, those two decisions are reflective of maybe 0.1% of all the decisions I made that we got right most of the time. The vast majority of the time you get these decisions right because you're well trained and you're thinking clearly and you're doing the right thing. And it's those ones that you get wrong which are so stark in contrast that stick with you. And you know, while not everybody has those experiences, many, many people have very similar experiences where they don't remember the vast majority of the time you did it right.
Yeah.
You know, what sticks with you and keeps you up at night is the screw-ups. Not the screw-ups, the miscalculations, the fog of war, the thing that was going to happen eventually and it was just a matter of time.
Yeah.
So that would be one example among many, many examples.
Yeah, no, there's so many powerful pieces in the show, and I'm really it's really great that you put this out there, you know, your own personal diaries, your own journals.
It was a little weird for me.
Yeah. But it's a great show, and I hope that, you know, folks can get out there and see it. But I really, really, it's really great that you and Peter put this show together. And I want to thank you both for being on the show, and you as well. So, Mike, I want to quickly reference, too, that you have a book coming out, The Untold Stories from Iraq, Photojournalists on War. And how many photographers is this?
It's an oral history of the war as told by 39 photographers. And, you know, as we've been talking today about how complex a story this is and how complex a war and a conflict it was, you know, I think having 39 voices in there, there's different points of view, you know, and that's different parts of the country. People were there at different times. Europeans who were rabidly anti-war, Americans that thought the war was a good idea, and we try to put all their voices together, as well as a lot of photos that have never been published in the United States. So that's what the book is about. We're hoping that it'll be a source for people who are interested to go out and read about it and get some idea of what really happened over there.
All right, well, I want to thank all three of you. We're out of time. Peter, Tim, and Mike, thank you guys for doing this.
Our pleasure.
Thank you.
All right. So this is WFMU. East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in Rockland County, and 91.9 FM. Nardwar is up next. And, so thanks again.
Money! Don't worry about it! Make it rain! No one's counting! Show it off! Listening to WFMU, and it's time right now for the Nardwuar, the Human Serviette radio show. You just heard right there from Austin, Texas, the Charles Edward Cheese Band with Chapel of Love. Thank you so much, Gene Defcon, from the Charles Edward Cheese Band from Austin, Texas, for sending me that track. And you gotta see pictures of the Charles Edward Cheese Band and check them out at the Incredible Earl Cheeseband.com. The Charles Edward Cheese Band, as I mentioned, from Austin, Texas. And today on the Nardwuar to Human Serviette radio show, interviews I did at the South by Southwest Music Festival in Austin, Texas. Gonna hear interviews with rapper Pusha T and comedians Fred Armisen and Mark Maron. And I'd like to give a special shout out to Tom Sharpling of The Best Show, who helped set up my interviews with Mark Maron and Fred Armisen. One call to Tom Sharpling delivers two interviews to you, the listeners of the Nardwuar to Human Serviette radio show of the Comedy Persuasion, and also an interview that Tom did not set up with Pusha T, as I mentioned. Pusha T, the rapper from Virginia Beach. So, coming up, interviews with Fred Armisen and Mark Maron, and again, thank you so much, Tom Sharpling, for setting those interviews up. Plus, an interview with Pusha T, and I'm going to play two tracks right now by a CD that was handed to me, a double shot. A lot of times when DJs play double shots, they burp saying the word double shot. I'm not going to say that, but I'm going to say the name of the band, the Mystic Knights of the Cobra. This CD was handed to me at South by Southwest by the amazing Mystic Knights of the Cobra, and we're going to hear two shots, as I mentioned, a double shot, El Camino and Foxy Roxy by Mystic Knights of the Cobra. And then Pusha T, and then Fred Armisen, and then Mark Maron, all on the Nardwuar, the Human Serviette radio show on WFMU.
Get in the back seat. You want to come in? Hello. I got a little stick shift action.
Yeah.
Like that.
Yeah, uno,
nice.
Dos, uno, tres, cuatro, seis.
El Camino. The front is like a car. The back is like a truck. The front is where we kiss. The back is where we El Camino. El Camino. The front is like a car. The back is like a truck. The front is where we kiss. The back is where we El Camino. The back is like a truck. The front is where we kiss. The back is where we El Camino. 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 Back is like a truck. The front is where we kiss. The back is where we El Camino. El Camino. El Camino. El Camino. El Camino.
to the champagne room. Once again, Samir and Emil to the champagne room. Ladies and gentlemen, coming to our center stage is the sweetest gal in Sugar City, Foxy Roxy.